What is something that people may not know about the center position?
Something people may not know about the center position. Let me think about that for a second. We'll cut it. Can we cut it?
Yeah, we can cut
okay.
it.
Okay. I don't know. I guess I don't want to be funny about it. I guess I want to be more serious
about
it, right?
You could be funny. It would be fine.
Okay. All right. Some of the people... no, that's not dumb. That's corny.
We'll come back. You want to come back?
Yeah, let's come back to that.
Okay, so how old were you in the year 2000?
In the year 2000, I was 3 years old.
What's your favorite NSYNC song?
NSYNC? Wait, what?
The band.
Who's that?
Oh, that answers it.
NSYNC.
Who was your favorite Destiny Child's member?
Never heard of that either.
What was something people don't know about the center position and why?
Is that the last one? Oh, God. Okay.
We'll change it. All right, back to your favorite question. What is something that people do not know about the center position and why?
Well, it's definitely probably one of the more difficult positions on the O-line in terms of a lot of offenses make centers set protection, set run game targeting. And so that's something that we do as centers that viewers at home might not know that we do. And in my opinion, it's definitely one of the tougher positions on the field because you don't have a lot of room for error, especially when you're right in front of the quarterback.
The third time is a charm for Kentucky center Drake Jackson. He's on the Remington Trophy watch list. Will he win? Well, only time will tell as we've reached the midpoint of the regular season in college football. The Husker Doc Talk podcast is presented by the Remington Trophy. The award is given annually to the nation's top center. Now in its 20th year, the Remington Trophy winner will be announced at the ESPN College Football Awards Show in December. He will be honored at the Remington Trophy Celebration Dinner Saturday, January 18th, 2020 at the Rococo Theater in Lincoln. The Remington Trophy Celebration benefits the Boomer Esiason Foundation and the fight against cystic fibrosis. For more information, go to remingtontrophy.com. The beer we drink on this podcast is provided by the Infusion Brewing Company. Did you know you can take brewery tours? It's true. The Benson Tap Room has one every Saturday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the West Omaha Tap Room and Production Brewery Tours are also on Saturdays at 2. Tours are free and include a 5-ounce pour of any beer in the tap room. Reservations are appreciated. Also, private tours are available for parties of 10 or more by reservation. Visit infusionbrewing.com. A little later in this podcast, you will hear Ticket Talk with Ticket Express. Whether you are buying or selling, Ticket Express is your first and only stop. TicketExpress.com. Are you prepared for game day when it's colder outside? Let Husker Hounds get you bundled up. Fall and winter fashions are arriving daily. 3 locations in the Omaha area or online at HuskerHounds.com. I am convinced every Husker fan goes to HuskerMax.com when it wants big red news. HuskerMax distributes this podcast. HuskerMax is the number one website for the latest Husker news. You get fresh links, original content, message boards, and more. HuskerMax.com. This is a reminder that you can always send us questions by email, DocTalkSports@gmail.com. Also, follow Dr. Rob on Twitter, @DocTalkSports. No matter where you find us, Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, make sure to take the time and give us a like. If you're feeling extra generous, throw in a written review. The more you're talking about us, the more people will find us. This is the Husker Doc Talk podcast presented by the Remington Trophy, 2019, episode 18. Dr. Rob, last week, the title of the podcast was Nebraska's Offense Sucks. Now, and you went into why the Nebraska offense sucks, and it wasn't just all a negative podcast. You brought out some good things. Now, we knew with Adrian Martinez being banged up, the Nebraska offense may struggle at Minnesota. One thing I don't think I anticipated, I don't think you anticipated, was the defense being abysmal. I mean, horrible at Minnesota.
We've seen it in recent years. I never anticipated seeing those guys get pushed around and those guys being that far out of position play after play after play and lacking the ability to adjust to it. And Minnesota wasn't really doing anything all that special. I mean, this was – and I think I had a tweet that I put out about something to the extent of wait until we see Wisconsin and Iowa, because they've got, I think, a better, more disciplined offensive lines on both of those teams. Wisconsin definitely has a better running back, but they execute that same zone blocking scheme that Minnesota does. I mean, a lot of teams use it. This isn't like some kind of secret offense that only the Wisconsin Badgers use or only Iowa uses. I mean, using a zone blocking scheme where you've got that cutback option is something that a lot of teams do. And Minnesota ran it to perfection against us. The fact that you have a defense where guys have to maintain those assignments, and when they don't, this is what you see happen. You get one or two guys out of position in that zone blocking scheme, the running back's going to have two options. And if a guy's out of position towards the front side, he's going to cut back on you. If he's out of position towards the back side, you're going to go play side with it. But that running back's always going to have that play side or that cutback option in a zone blocking scheme, as long as you've blocked it halfway decently. And Minnesota did.
You know, I give PJ Fleck a hard time with his row the boat mantra, and he's a really fast talker, and I find him to be more of a salesman.
Oh, the guy drives me freaking nuts, and he still does.
Because he's arrogant and he's successful. It's just one of those things that just gets under your skin. But he said something, I mean, listening to him yesterday, it's rare that you have coaches come in and talk about what they knew could work. And then he goes, you know what? When he looked at Nebraska's line, he goes, they're tall, they're big, they carry a lot of mass, but he went in to say if he felt they could get them moving side to side, that they could expose that. You rarely hear a coach open up what
the problem is. That's the whole point of a zone blocking scheme, is to do that. So this isn't exactly
okay,
in my opinion. That was coach bullshit of him trying to talk like he knows what he's talking about.
But he puts it in layman terms where most people go, okay, I understand that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that's exactly what a zone blocking scheme is designed to do. And we did that at Nebraska all throughout the 1990s. You'd get a team, you'd get those guys, you'd use double teams along the line of scrimmage to get those defensive linemen moving laterally. We also pushed them back. I mean, that was kind of the idea, too, is we wanted to push them backwards. But you get them moving to the side, and that's what opens up those gaps. That's what opens up those backside, those cutback running lanes, is that lateral movement. So that's... I don't know if that's exactly groundbreaking knowledge on Coach Fleck's part here. Now, that doesn't mean Minnesota didn't execute that to perfection. They absolutely did.
I guess what I meant by my statement was that it's rare that a coach comes in, usually it's, hey, you know, we did a really good job, we pounded hard, we blocked well. Rarely does a coach go into and explain it in maybe a layman's terms, where if you're listening on the drive home, go, oh, okay. Because you're assuming everybody in the stadium knows what the hell a zone blocking scheme is. That's not true. You're assuming everybody in the media room knows what a zone blocking scheme is. That's not true.
I thought sports media were the smartest people on the planet.
Oh no, not even close. I'm one of the dumbest guys on the planet. I'm sure many people listen to this podcast go, yeah, Trav's not lying there. That's the first thing he's got accurate this entire season is when he says he's not very smart. But what I do know is when we start drinking good beer. And this week, you can tell it's getting colder outside because the beer is getting darker, right?
I mean, it always happens. Yeah,
it's like as the seasons change, the leaves will change, and so will the color of the beer. We are drinking from Infusion Brewing Company this week, the Barrel Age Castles in Vermont Maple Brown Ale. Now, this is alcohol by volume, 5.7%.
So not off the charts.
Not off the charts, but they only serve it in 12 ounces.
It tastes heavier than that in the alcohol content.
Now, here's what's cool about it. This is truly a local beer. So Infusion teamed up with the local 402 homebrewers clubs and made this maple brown ale that's loaded with roasty malts and maple syrup and aged in Patriarch whiskey barrels for 5 months. And I said, before I even told you what the beer was, I go, what do you think? And you're like, there's some liquor in this. You knew it's right
like,
away.
It's like cask aging or something.
Yes. But they keep it in the barrels for 5 months. Now it's pretty dark. I mean, it's dark. Now, but you know, it's amazing to me when somebody sees like a dark beer, like, oh, I can't touch that. Well, it's not as there's a lot of dark beers out there that are so super smooth. Yeah. You wouldn't even have a clue. You got to try it. Now this one, I can see myself having a glass, maybe a glass and a half.
I don't know if I'd call it smooth.
No, it's not smooth.
Yeah, I like it a lot. It's good. It's not a smooth drinking beer. It's a very good beer.
And this is the best way to describe what we're saying. That you can go have a beer. Like last week, we had the Mexican Lager. That's a beer you could sit in an infusion, drink eight of those. Because it was like 4.3, no problem, light, super crisp. Like, this is awesome. This is one you walk in, you have one, maybe two.
I mean, it's like, you think about it like IPAs. IPAs are not smooth beers.
No.
That's, I guess, what I mean. This is still, it's a great beer. It is not a smooth beer. This would be, you have one of these with dinner.
Yeah. It's a dinner beer. Very good.
Yeah,
the Castles in Vermont Maple Brown Ale. So go to Infusion Brewing Company, either in Benson or in the Southwest location. Check it out and go online to infusionbrewing.com. So Nebraska gives up 322 yards on the ground. 322
yards.
What
was the time of possession of the game?
Minnesota had the more time of possession. Had the ball 32-47. Nebraska had it 27-13.
So not as off the charts as I thought. But, I mean, Minnesota had a couple of drives there, a couple drives in the second half where they scored following 40-plus yard pass plays, which, again, I think it kind of – normally when you see those kind of rushing yardages and you see that kind of score, you think, oh, my God, they just dominated time of possession. And they had the win. I mean, they beat Nebraska in the time of possession, but not as much as you would have thought looking at the score. As much as Nebraska's defense got pounded, which I wonder if this defense is getting definitely probably mentally, but I'm sure physically tired a little bit at this point in the season. They haven't had a bye week yet. But when you have to rely on one side of the ball versus the other to win games, you can kind of there's a little bit of an exhaustion that creeps in. And throughout most of this first half of the season, Nebraska's had to rely on the defense to win games. It's just something that's had to happen. And I think that's part of what made this game kind of surprising is that they've done a fairly good job of it. I mean, when you look at there's really only one. I mean, I guess I say that I'm kind of throwing the Ohio State game out. In the games that Nebraska's been in, the defense has normally shown, even against Illinois. Nebraska spotted Illinois a lot of points, and that was mostly Nebraska's offense's fault with the turnovers. The defense, actually, I thought, on the whole, played fairly well against Illinois. But that Ohio State game and even this game, I thought Nebraska played worse on defense this game than against Ohio State.
You know, losing is one thing, right? I mean, you can lose a game, and this goes for any sport, any team, and go, all right, you got beat, and just move on, especially if you give a great effort. I think what's bothering a lot of people about yesterday's loss
did not look like a great effort.
It was not a great effort. And that falls squarely on the coaching staff, doesn't it? Doesn't that fall on the coaching staff of having a team prepared?
It does. The part of it, though, too, and this is something that I'd worried about going into this game, or I say going into this game, going into this season for that matter, is Nebraska's depth. And Nebraska does not have really any depth whatsoever. They've got a little tiny bit on the defensive line. After that, they really don't have any depth. And you're seeing that on offense right now. Thinking about this over the last day here, I mean, when you look at Nebraska's offense, if you really want to delve into the lack of talent, and this is something that I think Frost and his staff have worked hard to overcome, and they have to a degree when you look at some of the players they have, but the guys they're dealing with on offense, outside of the quarterback position, Who are Nebraska's big playmakers? It's J.D. Spielman. It's Maurice Washington. It's Wandale Robinson. That's really about it. Now, when you look at those three guys and you think about what a team wants to be able to do and needs to be able to do offensively, you got to have that vertical passing game. You've got to be able to throw the ball downfield on occasion. You got to have sort of that mid-range slot receiver split end passing game. You got to have a featured running back or featured running backs that you can rely on to carry you with a good, hard, pounding running game. And then you also need those guys, I call them the third down backs. You need those guys who, the scat backs, the slasher running types, the guys who can catch the ball out of the backfield. You need a group of guys like that. And when you look at Nebraska and you look at those three guys on offense, their main playmakers, when you're looking at Spielman, Wandale Robinson, and Mo Washington, I know Spielman's essentially a wide receiver, but if you actually look at him and really start taking a look at his skill set, he's a third down running back playing split end slot wide receiver. When you look at Wandale Robinson, same thing. He's kind of a hybrid wide receiver, third down running back. When you look at Maurice Washington, he's a third down running back. He's a scat back. Those are the kind of guys that I know Frost used at Central Florida, which I don't know if that's a great example of a sample size, because he was there for 2 years, two seasons. That was it. I think Frost would really like to have a Divine Azigbo back. There isn't one on the roster.
You brought it up last week. You were specific. I mean, you went in depth on Divine Azigbo.
I mean, the same thing with not having a Stanley Morgan. We have zero deep threat at the wide receiver. We have no true wide receiver that's been shown to at least be capable in a game situation. And so you're trying to do all things that you need to do offensively with three guys who are essentially all out of the exact same mold. They're all third down running backs / hybrid slot wide receivers. That's it. That is all Nebraska has. That is the lack of depth on this team right now. And I think Frost and his staff have worked hard to overcome it by getting Mo Washington, by getting Wandale Robinson, by getting some of these other guys. It's just you don't fix that lack of depth that fast. And then you look at the offensive line. I mean, I want to like these guys in the direction they're going, but you got to keep in mind you're still dealing primarily to a great degree with Riley recruits, and Riley recruited small. Bo Wilson is not a big offensive guard. Trent Hickson is not a big offensive guard. Brendan Hymus is not a big offensive tackle. Farniok's kind of a big guy. I think they got him listed at around 330, and quite frankly, I think he'd be a better ball player around 315. But it just, they just don't have the horses. They literally don't. And I think the guys they have, I'm not denigrating them in the sense that these guys aren't going out there and trying, but I think they got a little bit overmatched. And I think Nebraska's in a position where they were exceedingly limited and have been really limited as to what their offensive capabilities have been going into this season from game one.
Tim actually has a question, because this is where this podcast is getting now. People watch the game, they get pissed off, and they go, I'm going to write Dr. Rob. So Tim says, third quarter of the Minnesota game.
The game was over at that point,
but he decided, you know what, game's over. I'm going to pick up my phone. I'm going to email Dr. Rob. He says, is the size discrepancy still so bad between Nebraska and other teams? Announcers did not think so. Minnesota felt it was. If size and strength is getting solved, why is Nebraska getting pushed back 6 feet deep?
Greg, it's a good question. It's not solved. They've made huge strides. They're in the process of getting there. But I've said that kind of physical development takes 2 to 3 years to develop. Again, look at Nebraska's offensive line. You've got juniors and sophomores You got a walk-on sophomore guard. You've got a redshirt freshman center that they had to move over from tight end. And I understand the whole snap thing. He's still the best center on the team. I mean, it's just because there's one aspect of his game lacking doesn't mean he's not the best center on the team. He's still the most explosive blocker on that line. So I get the question. It's a 2 to 3 year process, and I'm going back to talking to some of the guys in the program back in during spring ball of 2018. And those guys saying this is going to be a 2 to 3 year process before we get to where people are happy. That puts us at 2020, 2021, not 2019.
So Jason, who is stranded in SEC country, he's in Memphis, Tennessee, says, listen, I bought into all the hype of the Zach Duvall program. I bought into the hype of the Dave Ellis Nutrition too, but it's nearly 2 years in and Nebraska guys are still getting manhandled, especially evident in Big Ten play. Can you, Rob, really keep saying you need more time?
Yeah.
Or can you only do so much with the current talent?
It does take – you. Okay. That's a pretty good question, and there's kind of two answers here. One, you need more time. You absolutely do. But there's also a reasonable statement there in the sense that, yeah, there's only – with certain amount of talent, there's only so much you can do. That is true. That's a good point.
But he also follows it up with the last question, or is Nebraska not developing? And he goes, gasp, that's blasphemy. Is this coaching group developing talent?
I think they are. I just don't – that again, I've been saying this for 2 years. That cupboard was bare, and we didn't really know how bare it was until we got half a year into Frost's tenure in Lincoln. I mean, it was.
You okay there?
Yeah, I'm dying here. Last round of seasonal allergies. the cupboard was that bare. And again, I just made the point about when you look at, okay, who does Nebraska have on their roster? Offensively, again, from a playmaker standpoint, I'd love to see the tight ends more involved. But again, you've got three slot wide receivers / third down running backs who are completely playing out of position at multiple times and in multiple situations. Really, do you think Wandale Robinson, I mean, he's an incredibly powerful runner for a guy of his size. But when you look at him, are you looking at him going, okay, this is your every down featured running back is Wandale Robinson or Mo Washington? Those guys are going to get killed. And they have been. Seven games in. We're 4-3. So they're 7 games into the season. And those two guys, arguably the two best offensive players on the roster, are completely banged up at this point because it's all they've got. They have to rely on these guys.
And that's what you're saying about the depth. There may be talent there, but you need talent in the second and third positions. Because if one goes down...
You need them in the second string, yes, third string spot. But you also need talent at tight end. You need talent at wide receiver. You need talent at all 5 offensive line positions. It's just, they don't have that yet. And that takes a few years to build. I know people, he's had 2 years. Really? That's the lack of patience that the fan base has at this point. I remember it used to be kind of like, it was like carved in stone. You didn't question a coach until he had been there at least 5 years. Because that's how long it took. And now in this day and age, it's...
Because Mike Riley didn't get 5 years.
You saw a regression, I think, from year one.
I would agree with you. I'm not disagreeing.
Bill Callahan, I actually thought by year two, year three, in terms of recruiting, the talent building, I didn't see the development of guys as much as I saw lots and lots and lots of talent. But by year two, year three, you're sitting there going like, God, these guys, they're going to bowl games again. You're knocking off Michigan and... I don't even remember what bowl game it was, but you beat
Michigan. That was the Alamo Bowl, wasn't it?
Might have been. They beat Michigan, though, in a bowl game after Callahan's second season. I think went to the Cotton Bowl after his third.
That's the day Greta was born. Went down and played Auburn. And he got bullheaded in that game and should have won that game.
He started. Do you know what he did? He took over play calling.
Yes.
And his dumbest thing he ever could have done. Callahan actually, his defensive staff was horrendous. He actually had a very good offensive staff on that team. And if he had just let them, if he had delegated and let them do what he hired them to do, they would have won a lot more games. But I thought going into year two, year three, there was kind of this sense of progress. And then it all fell apart year four. But there was multiple issues within the athletic department program at that time. And some of that spilled over onto Callahan and killed him there.
You make fun of the Iowa sign of culture trumps a lot of things. The culture of Nebraska at that time was horrible. It was a bad culture.
It was a horrendous culture. And there's a lot of things that Frost is doing that the previous two or three coaches didn't do that I think is excellent and that I really like. And I think it's great building for long-term success. You're just not going to see results from that kind of stuff for two or three years. You don't see results from strength and conditioning programs until you're into year three, year four. You don't see it from recruiting until you're in year two, year three, year four. It takes a while for a lot of these things to work and to pan out.
Roger in Olathe, Kansas, and I got to break down his email because it's very long. I'm gonna copy edit as I go. He says, it appears the vision defense is not taught or used by the defensive coaching staff. He says, defensive football is about reacting time. I would rather react by using vision and peripheral vision techniques than reading keys. Tackling, focusing on the offensive player, carrying the ball, waistline, and using peripheral vision to see the side area around him. It's a lot harder to be faked out by a ball carrier and easier to strip the ball if the defensive player's vision is focused on the waist area. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, but that's kind of fundamental coaching right there. The thing he talks about cluing in on keys, though, there's not a lot of defensive coaches who aren't coaching that. I mean, that's pretty standard coaching that. I mean, guys are going to key. I mean, you're looking at specific keys. Hey, how is the offensive lineman stepping? Are you seeing an offensive lineman block down on a defensive lineman? Linebackers are reading that kind of thing all the time. So I disagree a little bit in the sense that you shouldn't be going off of keys, because I think that's basic defensive coaching across the board.
Mark says, you know, after the Minnesota game, the only thing that he can take away is that Nebraska absolutely does not have the personnel to put a competitive team on the field. Thus, can you talk recruiting? According to Husker 247, Nebraska has 421 offers out. Thanks, Mark. Well, Mark, you're never going to hear me talk about recruiting because I hate recruiting. I hate talking about high school kids and the difference they may make. But recruiting is part of the game, and that is where you find talent. So I understand
that. It is. It's an absolute inexact science.
But 421 offers?
They do. They put a lot out. Which, if you look at the Alabamas and those, I don't know if they're that many, but they got a lot out as well, too. Them, Clemson, so on and so forth. I'm sure there's an algorithm out there that says you get a yes, like one yes for every 37 offers you put out there. So they kind of have to do that, especially in this day and age where everybody kind of knows everything about every single recruit that's out there. And so if you're not making those offers, I think you get left behind really quickly.
Kenneth says, Dr. Robin Travis, it seems like night games are a guaranteed recipe for lack of focus for this team and staff. Coach Frost has said before he's not a big fan of them at all, preferring daytime games. Does that mindset work its way through the staff and their approach? Not something that is likely to change due to TV rights, but wondered on your thoughts on a remedy.
Hard to find a remedy for that. When I've always thought that night games require a massive amount of focus, and they do for good teams. And I remember when I played at Nebraska that you loved playing under the lights. You loved the fact that you had a region, at least a regional, but usually a national TV audience watching you play when you played in those night games. Loved them, loved them, loved them. I hated the day-long buildup. The best thing in my mind was that 1 p.m. game. Get up, eat breakfast, go to team meetings. You had a little bit of downtime, not a lot, but you had a little bit of downtime. You'd have a quick pregame meal, bus over to the stadium, play the game.
I had former Iowa State quarterback, former Seattle Seahawks quarterback, Seneca Wallace, on my radio show.
Hell of an athlete.
He was a great athlete. He said the exact same thing. He goes, I didn't like night games. He goes, the ideal for me was the 2:30 game. Because back when he was playing, it was 11, 2:30, or 7. He goes,
early mid-afternoon games are the best. I liked anything early mid-afternoon because, again, if you're sitting around all day, it physically and mentally kind of tires you out. And again, I think I've talked about this before. What do most people do at night? They go to bed.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's not like athletes are different. Nighttime rolls around. You get tired. You want to go to bed.
How did you stay busy in like the hotel room and stuff when you're on the road? I mean, because that's what Seneca said. Seneca said it was horrible because you'd sit around. You'd get bored. There wasn't anything to do. You'd sit in your room. He goes, it just drove you nuts because you were trying to think about the game, but
if you didn't have specific things going on, team meetings, et cetera. Okay, I mean, I remember Milt Tanniper would always try and do a good job of he'd go grab the offensive line, basically, hey, we're gonna go for a walk. Literally, just get up and move around a little bit, kind of shake off the rust, just kind of clear our minds, get out of the hotel. We're gonna go walk across campus for a little bit, just sort of hang out. And things like that are always good. But, I mean, you'd always try and squeeze a nap in there. You'd do a little bit of game prep, look over some kind of review some game film, or you'd go look at some play sheets, things like that. But there's only so much of that you can do, and a lot of the time you would just try and take a nap and watch some of the other games that were playing on TV. But that downtime almost kind of wears you out. That sitting around and waiting wears you out. That anticipation can be mentally exhausting. And that's why I think most players, they love the game itself, the night sky, the lights, the knowing they've got that big TV audience. All of them hate the buildup. That day-long buildup's horrible.
You know, we're coming up on the bye week right now for Nebraska, so they're not going to play this Saturday. And there were some comments, and I've learned as I've gotten older that, you know, when you hear something, it may be not entirely what was meant to be said. But you heard, and I'm paraphrasing now, Scott Frost saying maybe it's a good time for these guys to get away from one another. You heard some players say, you know what, we just need some time away. How should one interpret that? Because it is weird to say.
You know, I didn't think it was at all. When I heard that, the first thought that went through my head was basically like, yeah, that totally makes sense. I agree. I thought that was a very natural thing. The reason I say that is when you look at the situation that these guys are in, think about all the anticipation we had, all the expectations we had as fans, the media expectations, pick all the people who had Nebraska picked to win the Big Ten West, et cetera. That puts a lot of pressure on you as a player. These guys are going through a massive transition. You think they don't think all these things we're saying that we say about them, the lack of recruiting, the lack of physical development. These guys know they haven't been in a weight room up until the last 18 months. All of a sudden, they had to start working out with Duvall, and it was a shock to them. Like, oh, my God, what if we'd been doing this since we stepped foot on campus? they know they haven't done everything they could have done. I know some of last year's seniors, I mean, like Luke Gifford and Gerald Foster, some of those guys touched on that a little bit, just the whole, we didn't know what we didn't know. And it's disappointing to us that we spent 2 or 3 years prior to Frost arriving, not working out, not constantly preparing. These guys know that. They know that they're behind the eight ball a little bit. That puts a lot of mental and even more so emotional pressure on these guys. And so I think going into this year where there are these high expectations, they're obviously not living up to them. You're seeing this lack of depth, the lack of guys like having a featured running every down running back, the lack of a true wideout. That's, I mean, they've got true wideouts on the roster, but nobody that has any level of productivity. The players realize all this stuff too. It's not like they're stupid and they don't see the forest for the trees. They're seeing the same stuff we're all seeing, and they know that. That puts a lot of pressure on you, a lot of emotional. It's emotionally exhausting. And so when Frost said that, I thought it made perfect sense to me, and I wholeheartedly agree.
Jessica Friedman back with me for another edition of Ticket Talk. And Jessica, unscripted interview here. So I'm going to ask you, it's now been announced Nebraska is going to play in Dublin, Ireland in what, 2021. So are people already calling you wanting tickets to see the Huskers in Illinois and Ireland?
We haven't gotten the calls yet, but there's definitely excitement for it. Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. Yeah, there's a lot of Huskers excited, but they'd also like them to have a more winning record than this season.
Well, I would say by 2021, that should happen. I'm just anxious to see how you guys come up with tickets in Dublin and how that all works.
Yeah, that's a toughie because we handle nationwide. We've dabbled in international events from time to time, and it's a different tool set needed there.
Were you surprised when you heard they were going to go play in Ireland? I was. When I heard it, I'm like, huh, that's interesting.
I was a little bit, but you're really seeing a push to introducing sports, particularly in the European markets. You know, the NFL did it. So it's kind of been paving the way for college football to follow suit.
So this is the bye week for Nebraska. Do you guys just sit around the office and do absolutely nothing this week? Is that what happens over here?
We emulate you and Dr. Rob, and we bring in some beer and we talk about it. That's exactly what happens.
So really, what do people now, besides football, what's coming up that people should keep an eye on?
You know, Nebraska volleyball is still going strong, and so that's definitely big. Basketball tickets are starting to come out, so the chatter for basketball has become a big thing. The Billie Eilish concert coming to Omaha has created a lot of buzz. That's pretty exciting.
Okay, help me out. Who's Billie Eilish? I'm being dead serious here.
You should go ask your kids, Trav. They'll know all about her. She's an independent artist that's really raised herself up. She's 17 years old, which makes her the same age as JoJo Siwa, but they're very different markets. But she announced an arena tour, and she's sold the entire tour out already, including her stop in Omaha.
You mean she doesn't paint her face and dance around and cater to the Nickelodeon crowd? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, she's not selling hair bows.
No, my kids want Jonas Brothers. Two of my kids have Jonas Brothers. My youngest wants Jonas Brothers.
Trav, we're here to help you with those Jonas Brothers tickets.
Yeah, I know I'm probably going to cave, but don't tell my daughter Greta that. But if you want any concert tickets, if you want any sports tickets, if you want any ticket whatsoever, here in the United States, here in Omaha, here in Nebraska, and soon to be internationally, Dublin, TicketExpress.com is the place to go. TicketExpress.com. Jessica, thanks.
Thank you.
All right, Rob, the Huskers have a bye week. Do you have a bye week? Are you going down to see your daughter at Florida State? You doing anything like that?
Yeah, I'm not. I got to work.
You got to work?
Yeah.
You got to stick people in the back with needles and stuff?
That's a great gig.
Because you have the God complex, man. I mean, you play God.
Oh, please.
A little bit?
Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, that's what I thought. Man, so no football for you this weekend. I thought you would have bolted town.
Well, hey, I got to be careful there. My son plays for Westside.
How about Westside kicking the shit out of Elkhorn South last week? So do you and your brother like text during that game? Like, hey, I'm kicking the shit out of you, little brother, I did all my life?
My phone died early.
Really?
Yeah. So it's Yeah, so my phone fritzed. I think it was the cold weather. I had it in like an outer pocket of my coat. So I think my phone literally froze up on me. My brother sent me one text. Westside had a 28-0 lead at the end of the first quarter. My brother sent me just one word, wow. And then my phone died right after that. So,
I mean, but that Elkhorn Southwestside game was like old home Husker week, right? Because you had your brother, you had you had Eric Crouch, Matt Hoskinson. I mean,
Lance Brown's starting quarterback, actual outstanding athlete.
Did you guys have like a Husker tailgate beforehand or anything like that?
They did it afterwards, which I felt bad because, which actually, even despite the loss, my brother and his family were hosting the post game parents get together at their house that they do after every Elkhorn South game. And they invited us. And even right after the game, I get in the car, get my phone worn back up, it repowers on. First text from my brother, hey, you guys going to stop by after the game, have a Coors Light? Which we couldn't, one, because we had to go pick up my son from the high school. He's not 16 yet. And so we had to go pick him up. And then at the same time, our daughter organized an impromptu sleepover at the house. So we had to get our butts back in gear for bunch of girls running around.
You know, I've been lucky as a parent. I don't think my girls, and I have three of them, never had like a major sleepover.
We haven't had huge, but I mean, it's one of those things where on any given weekend night, there's anywhere from, it's smaller numbers, but there's anywhere from like one to three girls that are all hanging out together in the basement watching a movie or whatnot.
Because the Zadiska house must be the cool house in the block.
It might be. It might be. I don't think I'm the cool dad, but my kids are probably way cooler than I am.
So, you know, when this season comes to an end, you're probably looking at Nebraska having, what, 6 to 7 wins, right?
I still think seven's a possibility. Okay, so I think Maryland is really, really bad. I think Purdue's really, really bad.
And that's fair. That gets you to 6 right there.
Yeah.
You got Wisconsin left. You got Iowa left.
Those are going to be – God, those are tough cards.
So,
right, but
so does Scott Frost then – because one thing when he was hired that I was worried about, I appreciated, though, was the loyalty. And he brought everybody from Central Florida. Do you think he does an evaluation of his coaching staff and possibly lets anybody go after this season?
I don't know if I've got a big issue with the individual coaches as much as I maybe do some of the system stuff that they've got installed. And I think when you looked at what Pelini did to set Nebraska up for success in the Big 12, where he had a defense that was geared to shut down these high-flying, speed-based, wide-open offenses that Baylor and Oklahoma State and Oklahoma and Texas were utilizing. Texas Tech the Pirate was still at Texas Tech at the time. I thought Pelini did a pretty solid job of building it up for that. And then all of a sudden, boom, we go to the Big Ten. And that defense kind of, I mean, it took a pounding. I mean, it got beat up a little bit because we didn't have these big behemoths who could stand in there against these brutal offensive lines from schools like Minnesota. You know, wouldn't have thought that, but apparently Minnesota's an O-line powerhouse now. And again, I'm not a coach. I think I've got a fairly high amount of football knowledge, but I'm not a coach. But I look at the situation and I think how you do certain things defensively, how you do certain things offensively. I haven't seen Nebraska run a really good, solid zone running system. They just don't have that in the playbook.
Okay.
And when you look across the Big Ten, almost everybody else does. And there's some teams that can get away without doing a lot of it. Even Ohio State that you look at is sort of a model of the spread option type offense. Even they do it. I mean, they were brutally effective with it against us a couple weeks ago. So, I mean, it's one of those things where it's a staple in the conference because it kind of needs to be. I think the best running teams at least have that package within their arsenal to use, and they can rely on it if need be, and Nebraska doesn't. And what that does, it kind of puts your running backs on an island and forces your running backs. Essentially, it kind of leaves your running backs in a situation of, hey, you're going to have one or two guys not block that. You just got to make miss. The zone blocking scheme tends to take care of that extra guy, that extra defender, whether it's with a tight end, a fullback. I get it. Frost doesn't utilize a fullback, really. Well, you know what? There's a lot of teams in the NFL who didn't utilize fullbacks, but they'd have kind of a hybrid position. We called it
the H-back, right?
Yeah. When I was with the Giants, we called it an H-back. And essentially, that was your mobile pass-catching tight end who, instead of being the 6'5", 260-pound tight end, was the 6'3", 245-pound tight end. And that was the H-back. We used the H-back a lot as a lead blocker out of the backfield. And that's something that I could see Frost. It'd be an easy install into his offense, I think. Get under center. You got some of these short yardage situations. Get under center more. On defense, it wouldn't bug me to see the return of a four-man front. And I know they went to that in the second half, but it's something that it's not your base package. And in the Big Ten, I think a lot of teams use it because, God, you know what? When you look at the offensive lines you're facing in the Big Ten, having a fourth deep down lineman in there is not a bad thing. So it's something that I think is worth rethinking.
What do you think of Noah Vedral? What do you think of his performance? Was it kind of an impossible situation that he was thrown into? Or does it show you just how far and above Adrian Martinez is above the rest of the field?
I think when Adrian's on the ball playing the game that he has the skill set to play, i.e. a little bit more quick read and react, I think he's the best by far. I liked Vedral for the fact that for the limited time he had in the second half, against Northwestern and this week against Minnesota, in his time against Minnesota, I thought he seemed very decisive. He'd make a decision, he'd go with it, win or lose, good play, bad play, he'd make a decision and go with it. And I really, really liked that. I don't think he's as good a pure athlete as Martinez, but he's still a pretty damn good athlete. And I think he was just put into an impossible situation where, again, he's got three incredibly talented cohorts on offense with Spielman, Robinson, and Washington. But those guys are oftentimes playing out of position. And both those quarterbacks need a feature running back. They need true wideouts. And they just don't have that right now.
You know, one of the big subjects is, and we're going to get off Nebraska now because they get a week off. They got beat. And I want to talk about something else because before we came down to record, you and I were just having a discussion about random things. And the California bill came up about, you know, paying players for their likeness. Mark Emmert from the Des Moines Register actually wrote a really long story for the USA Today that went into detail about if players were able to make money off their likeness. And that is go get endorsements, right? You know, probably an Adrian Martinez could probably bring in maybe $500,000 a year around here.
You could make a lot of money. And half a million's a lot.
They put Jordan Bohannon at Iowa at $400,000. If Jordan Bohannon can make $400,000 in Iowa City, Adrian Martinez can make up to $500,000.
Yeah, I'd give you that. Yes. If you want to talk about, I mean, the dollars, I mean, this sounds like pennies compared to the hundreds of thousands of dollar numbers. I remember spring after my senior year, just going to autograph signings. I think I made about 10 grand. That was back in 1995.
Yeah. Do they even do those anymore? Do they do autograph signings anymore? I mean, like they did when you, I mean, I remember going to cover you guys play like basketball games in high school.
Oh yeah. Husker hoops.
Yeah.
Baby.
Husker hoops. I mean, that was always kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean, we did all of that stuff. I mean, a lot of small town appearances across the state. So, I mean, if you're looking at us, I mean, this isn't advertising. This is just going and signing autographs for an hour. We're making 10 grand over a few months.
Yeah.
Some of these guys, excuse me, allergies are killing me. Some of these guys, yeah, like an Adrian Martinez, or in the time frame of when I played, like a Brooke Behringer, Tommy Frazier, a Schlesinger, an Amon Green. I mean, the amount of money those guys could make is mind-blowing.
So, but this is where the conversation went. I said, okay, let's say college athletes could start making money off their likeness. And I'm not going to get into, hey, if a lineman making no money and a quarterback's making so much money, how that divides a team up. My question is, when it comes to media scrutiny and fan scrutiny, it's always been, leave college kids alone. They're student athletes. They're not getting paid to play the game. Does this open up college kids to more criticism from media? And
I would say, yeah.
So do I.
If your likeness is out there, if you're willing to have your likeness to be out there, to have your image be out there, and you're going to make money off of that, then you've got to be open to that criticism. I mean, the example I gave was that when you go to the NFL, kind of the sort of the unwritten rule is fans and I mean the media, but the fans more have fair license to say anything they want about you to you during a game. And the underlying logic behind it is, you know what? They bought a ticket. That ticket's paying for your salary. You know what? They have literally, I mean, there's a line you can cross at some point, but for the most part, if they want to sit there and make fun of you and criticize you, man, more power to you. You're paying my bills, baby. So cut loose, say what you want.
So how about fans doing that to players at Memorial Stadium? They know you are endorsing some auto dealer, you're endorsing a furniture store.
If I get
store.
My tires done there, then
yeah,
there needs to be that expectation. Because now you're kind of crossing into, to a degree, the concept of professional athletics.
Yes.
And that's part of, I guess in pro sports, again, there's a line of, okay, that's in bad taste. As long as you don't cross that line, I mean, you're not talking about somebody's dead mother, for God's sakes. You're not cracking Salinesi jokes, which I find I hate Colorado. Find those jokes distasteful, though.
Come on, they're kind of funny.
I don't think so. Come on, yeah, dude.
Everyone's. Have you watched Chappelle's new show yet?
Yeah, that's actually pretty funny.
He holds back on nobody there.
No, he never does,
I know,
though.
But this one, Sticks and Stones, if you haven't watched it on Netflix.
It's awesome.
It is awesome. I mean, if you are easily offended or politically correct, not the show for you. When it starts off with an Anthony Bourdain joke, and it's all uphill from there, man. But
he crosses no line. I mean, I'm sorry. There is no line that he doesn't cross. So, but I mean, there's a line of good taste that, okay, I don't think you should cross. But as long as, I mean, in my mind, I always chalked that up as part of the entertainment experience. If you're entertained by that and you feel like you've paid for that entertainment experience, and some of that money's coming back to me in some way, shape, or form. Now, in Memorial Stadium, it's not a ticket sales thing, but you're there and you're benefiting off of your likeness to the tune of money in your pocket. If that increased exposure of you, your name, your image is making you money, you better believe that's going to set you up for more criticism.
and louder, and it won't be, hey, these are college kids, leave them alone. You're going to be, that college kid's making $500,000 a year.
Yeah, this is now a pro athlete.
Yeah,
this is
a pro athlete. So,
and so if that happens, I don't have a problem with that. And if you don't, as the athlete or an advocate for those athletes, if you don't like that, I mean, it's the trade-off for that, for those dollars.
So I must be getting philosophical in my old age, but I'm starting to really look at almost every decision that's made, and it doesn't prevent me from making decisions, but I always say, what's the unintended consequence of the decision? Because I think people make decisions with the best of intentions, right? Because I don't think people go, like, let's use the current redshirt rule where you can play four games and then redshirt. Kind of get your feet wet, but not, okay, what Dana Holgorsen did at Houston is a blatant unintended consequence of that rule, and that is take your best players, your season sucks, we're going to shut you down and redshirt you. That's not what that rule is meant for. Would you agree with that? These guys were seniors, all right? You don't go, hey, let's pull you out, wait another year until I get more talent, and then you're going to have a much better season. That's the unintended consequence of that rule. When it comes to not paying players from the university, when it comes to this profiting or making money off your name and likeness so you could endorse a car dealership or you endorse a tire shop, what's the unintended consequence that can happen here?
That's a good question.
Could it be a division? I mean, if my offensive line gets zero money.
I think you could see a division. I'm trying to, when you first mentioned that, I kind of started thinking about that. I was trying to extrapolate, how would I feel about that? And I don't know if I would feel that badly about it, because I'd be sitting there going, well, crap, you know what? I mean.
Yeah, but you're Dr. Rob Zadisky.
I'm an offensive lineman, for God's sake.
Yeah, but
sakes.
You knew you were going to be a doctor. You were going to be okay at the end of this thing.
I get that, but I think if everybody kind of takes care of what they ought to be taking care of academically, I think most of these guys should be okay eventually.
It's a big if.
It is. But I'm also kind of a firm believer in self-determination, and the decisions you make are what ultimately impacts you. I mean, I look at, say, like, now I think he's still floating around the NFL. I got to actually check the Giants roster, but you got Nick Gates, who decided he didn't want to stick around Nebraska when Frost hit the door, so he went pro. Well, what's the unintended consequence? He didn't get drafted. He should have stuck around. I think he would have gotten drafted if he had.
Yeah, he's still with the Giants.
Okay. Practice squad or full roster?
I don't have an answer to that.
Okay, so
I know
he's not playing much.
Wikipedia told me he's with the Giants.
Yeah, so I know he's not playing much, but it's there's still that a fair amount of the decisions you make can have that impact. It's one of those things. I mean, I think athletes are one of the groups of people who more than anybody else understands that idea of, hey, some of us are better than others. Some of us are worse than others. And shit, you know what? Life ain't fair. And athletics is one of the last kind of institutions of society that teaches that. I mean, people have tried to make it fair. They've done everybody gets a trophy. Everybody gets a ribbon. Everybody gets a participation medal at the end of the year. You know what? They do, but guess what? You hit a certain level, only the starters start. Only the people who are good play. And the guys who are the superstars are a superstar for a reason, and those are the guys who are going to rake it in over their likeness. And when I played college football, when I played pro football, you think I didn't understand that, hey, at the other tackle spot is an Outland Trophy winner, and he's going to get more pub than me. That the quarterbacks are going to be more well-known than I'll ever be. I understood that. I think athletes get that more than most other people do.
And I would agree with you. And that's why I think business leaders like to use athletes and athletics as examples of success and culture within their own organizations. But not everybody gets that. I mean, you have team members that want to have
in the best of situations, at least by intention, it's the last true meritocracy. If you're good enough, you're going to play. If you're not, you're not going to play.
I like that word meritocracy. I don't think I've ever used that before. Meritocracy.
I just did.
Did you make it up or is it a real word?
No, it's a real word.
Okay.
It's basically you've got a system based upon merit.
Merit or production too, right? I mean, like your top salespeople at an organization. Well, they're the top salespeople and make the most money because they produce.
They're good.
They're the superstars.
Yeah, Divine Azigbo. He became Nebraska's starting running back because he was the guy that could get the job done and keep that productivity up.
I'm going to give you two situations. What would you rather have happen for college athletics? Name and likeness payment or let's say, $25,000 a year put into a pretty conservative fund, and at the end of graduation, you get a check for $100,000 plus whatever interest is made. That's for every player. So you can say, hey, name and you only get to pick one, name and likeness, or the $100,000 guaranteed for every teammate. Your meritocracy's done.
No, that's a good question. I tend to lean more towards, if you can benefit from your own likeness, I think that's the route you go.
Okay.
And the I've got a couple reasons for saying that, because I think it goes both ways. If you're the guy who's the productive player, if you're the player who's the superstar, if you're the player who's truly that good, and if you're sitting there going, crap, I'm making all of this money, but it goes into a pool and everybody gets a cut of it. Okay, how come I don't get to keep what I just earned? I mean, that's communism.
Yeah. You're right.
I'm just saying.
But we're talking about universities here.
And I've experienced that a little bit. So at the time I played, let's say you earned an academic scholarship, you couldn't keep it. Or you could keep it, but your athletic scholarship was reduced by a like amount. At the same time, too, there was a number of academic-based awards that I won when I played. And when I won those, there was usually a five-figure dollar amount that would get awarded to the school's general scholarship fund. Now, hey, that's awesome.
That's your money.
It's like, hey, I literally just made Nebraska $10,000 with this quote unquote scholarship. I just made Nebraska $25,000 with that so-and-so scholarship. I mean, there was a bunch of those that I won my junior and senior year where you were the such and such award, you were the such and such player of the game, you were the such and such scholarship winner, and some five-figure dollar amounts go into the school's general scholarship fund. Now, I was proud of the fact that I was able to earn that, and I appreciated the fact that somebody was going to benefit from that. I truly did. But I'm also human, and there's part of me sitting there going, huh, I just made a shit ton of money, and I don't get a dime. None of that goes to me. Now, if you're that superstar player, I understand that if that's the system that gets put into place where you make X amount of money, but you don't get to keep all of it, that everybody gets a cut. I think that can breed sort of a reverse resentment, as much as the example you gave is, hey, you got the star quarterback. How do you think the offensive line that's blocking for that guy feels about it?
Man, and that makes sense.
It does go both ways. Now, the other thing that what you mentioned, where sort of a spread the wealth system, there's a lot of money-making opportunities within college athletics where they could do that and barely put a dent into profit margins. The TV contract money, the bowl game money, the playoff money, which again, I'm still begging for the day that they expand the playoff at least to 8. It ought to be 16 teams.
I'm with you with the 16.
Yeah, I think it ought to be 16. Do you have any clue? I mean, because I don't. How much money that's going to make? It's going to be insane dollars.
It'd be in the billions, I think.
Absolutely. It is going to be insane dollar amounts if they do a full 16-team playoff. It's honestly, I know it's fewer games. I know it's fewer teams. But they go to a 16-team playoff in Division I football. It's, pardon the verbiage, it's going to be March Madness on steroids.
It would be. I don't disagree with that
And so you can take a minuscule percentage of the net profits from that and pay everybody. Because we've done this calculation before. I sat on NC2A committees. We looked at number projections and calculated out the dollar amounts. And we were talking like $3,000 per NC2A athlete in 1994 dollar amounts. And when I say NC2A athletes, I'm talking third string.
You went down to Division III.
Division III tennis players, Division II basketball players, Division I bowling team members. I'm talking everybody. If it is an NC2A sport, you get that cut. And there's enough money to do it out there and you could do it by barely putting a dent into these schools' profit margins that they're getting from the TV contracts, from the playoff money, so on and so forth.
He's Dr. Rob Zadiska. If you would like to stay in contact with Dr. Rob all week long, go to Twitter at DocTalkSports. Again, that's Twitter at DocTalkSports. He's pretty lively on the Twitter, so make sure to follow him. And if you have a conversation with him, he's more than happy.
I do try and answer questions.
You do.
If you tag me, or I don't know what is it called, tagging?
Yeah, tagging is a good way to do it. Yes,
I don't know if you
at DocTalkSports.
Yeah, if you at DocTalkSports, I'm going to try to answer most all those questions.
You can also reach out to Dr. Rob on email. That's DocTalkSports@gmail.com. That's DocTalkSports@gmail.com. Full disclosure, those emails actually come to me. I screen them. If there's some really good ones, I'll forward them to Rob. However, we do save most of those emails for the podcast, which you heard us read earlier. Again, that email address, DocTalkSports@gmail.com, DocTalkSports@gmail.com. For Dr. Rob Zadiska, I'm Travis Justice. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this edition of the Husker Doc Talk Podcast, presented by the Remington Trophy.